From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. A lot of today's show is about what has shaped the South, like the fight for racial equality. That's a victory hard won in places like Atlanta, with help from civil rights leaders like Andrew Young.
We could not let the South go back as it had in 1870. We had to bring the South forward in 1970, and I decided one way to do that was to run for Congress.
The South has also been shaped by the presence of people from places like Mexico. We'll talk with the author of a new book that tracks the history of Mexican migrants to Georgia and to other southern states. That's all coming up this hour. First, though, let's talk about trees. The endangered American chestnut tree was a topic of discussion yesterday. Martin Cipollini of the Georgia chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation taught us how to identify one of these beautiful trees if we're out in a forest.
Burrs on the ground. That's the thing that most people notice the first, that find some burrs, spiny sea urchin-looking burrs on the ground. The leaves are long, slender, with very deep, curved teeth. The leaves are essentially hairless. The trees that are producing burrs are often already covered with cankers, blight cankers. And so finding a tree that is producing these burrs that's completely free of blight is usually an indication that it's a Chinese chestnut.
We wanted to know what is growing in your backyards, and here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Gina, and I'm from St. Simons Island, Georgia. I'm calling to report about the trees that are in my yard. I have a bunch of live oaks in my yard, and I also have a beautiful little kumquat tree that produces very nice little tart kumquats. Anyways, that's the trees in South Georgia. All right, thanks.
We also heard from Stephanie Cleveland on Twitter. She tweets, "In my backyard, I have white oak, hickories, tupelos. I replaced some Chinese privet with eastern red cedars. Hashtag plant native plants. American chestnuts still play host to over 125 native Lepidoptera species. Asian chestnuts can't. Hashtag biodiversity." We want to know what you have growing or what's on your mind. Call us at 404-500-9457. Leave a message. We're also on Twitter at OST Talker. You can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comment on the show. Human beings can sometimes do incredible things when under pressure. Take, for instance, Alex Scarlatos of Oregon. He helped stop an alleged terrorist attack on a French train last summer. Here he is speaking at a news conference about the incident.
I didn't realize what it was at first until I saw a train employee run past us. At that point, I looked back and a guy with an AK entered the train cabin. So me and my friend got down and I said, basically, let's go. Told him to go, and he went. He tackled him.
Keep in mind, Scarlatos was a National Guardsman, so he's had extensive training. And now some police departments want to offer training to civilians as well. Tonight, Jefferson Police Chief Joe Werthman will host an active shooter seminar that's open to the public. Attendees will learn what to do to stay safe if they hear the rounds of gunfire. And Chief Werthman joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us is Chris Ferguson. He's a psychology professor at Stetson University in our neighbor to the south, Florida. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm glad that you're with us. Let me start with you, Joe. What kind of things can you teach? I mean, how long is the seminar?
It usually takes about 2 hours, and then afterwards we'll stay as long as it takes to answer any questions from the public.
So in 2 hours, you covered the basics, right? That's what you have time for.
Pretty much, yes.
And what is the basics?
Well, when there is a situation that you need to be aware of what's going on around you to avoid things, how to deny, keeping distance between you and the event, and how to defend yourself in case of an incident. Hopefully, you'll never be involved in an incident, but you got to take decisive action when there's no other alternatives.
Joe, are people relatively accurate about knowing when it's a gunshot that they're hearing?
No, it's, and I'm sure the psychologist there can talk more into that, but a lot of people, when they hear things, the first thing is denial. They think maybe fireworks or that wouldn't happen to them, and then that leads further on to slowing down your mechanisms, your internal mechanisms to get away or to see what really is happening.
Chris, that's sometimes referred to as sort of the deer in the headlights phenomenon. Why does that happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, what Chief Wortham is saying is absolutely accurate, that, you know, part of it is, you know, on the good side, these types of events, you know, remain, you know, pretty rare for the most part. So they're not part of our day-to-day experiences. So once something starts to happen, it's cognitively difficult for people to really, you know, get a grasp of what's going on. And that really can slow down their responses. Even when people may begin to understand that they are in a situation in which they're in imminent danger, their emotional reaction to that, their fear, their panic, can also inhibit appropriate responses to that. And that's kind of, we get that deer in the headlights type of phenomenon. Once people are kind of panicking, they may make decisions that are not in their best interest.
Can you even prepare for that, Chris? Because we all sit here, and anytime any of these kind of things happen, we think, gee, I wonder what I would do in that situation. But because, as you say, they are very, very rare, it seems to me that would be very difficult to actually train your mind to not panic.
Yeah, it can be difficult. I mean, you know, it certainly is outside the range of most of our experiences, unless we have some sort of background in law enforcement or something of that sort. You know, with these types of, you know, programs like the, you know, the avoid, deny, defense type of program, the idea behind it is to try to give as much information as possible. And the more exposure you have to these types of programs, you know, and even if you, you know, have some programs that may even run simulations and things like that, the idea is to really kind of give you cognitive information, pieces of information that you can refer back to when this sort of event happens, so that you don't have to sit there and try to think of what to do. You know, it's already ingrained into you. The more this sort of thing is practiced, the better and more automatic your responses to this type of event will be. And that's kind of what you want.
So, Joe, you guys use that, what Chris was just referring to in terms of the avoid, that avoid, and then last resort is defense, right?
That's correct.
Avoid, is that basically running away?
Well, it's to pay attention to your surroundings, you know, have an exit plan, move away from any source of the threat as quickly as possible, and put barriers between you and the person or the persons that are creating this issue. And getting back a little bit, you know, we have 156 people have already registered in our small little town, churches, banks, businesses, and what we're giving them is the initial, what they can do, we'll be putting out flyers that they can do the training themselves after they leave here. So they'll have a little a taste of what to do, and they can continue their training in their own businesses and in the churches and in the schools. And our police department, we do active shooter training with the police departments and here in the community, in our schools, on how we prepare and react. And if we can get some buy-in from the schools, which we have, and from my council and my city manager, have been very supportive, that hopefully it never happens, but if it does, we'll be able to respond appropriately.
Joe, how long have you been in law enforcement?
39 years.
Okay, so when I was in school, I grew up in California, so we ran earthquake drills, for example. I wonder, in almost four decades of law enforcement, could you have foreseen a time when you would be training civilians how to deal with mass shooting events?
No. Times have changed drastically. When I came on the job in the 70s, we didn't even have walkie-talkies, cell phones, you know, pictures on cell phones. So technology, social media, that has just grown by leaps and bounds. But we have to keep ahead of the curve as law enforcement. And when these new things come out, we got to do the training. And we can't do it ourselves. We need the community to work with us, to be our eyes and ears in the community. Without that, I mean, we're just totally reactive.
Chris, one of the things that is often a subject of debate after these kind of events is whether or not civilians should step in and try to take down a shooter. And I've often heard soldiers and law enforcement say, you know, it not even highly trained individuals are great at doing that at all times, that it shouldn't be attempted by the average person. What is it about that moment that can sometimes lead to mistakes? Why is it that sometimes a civilian without a lot of training or a lot of experience can make the wrong move?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it really comes down to that, you know, we're really not great processors of information, and particularly under times of intense stress. You know, we're really not great at, you know, processing data and knowing how to respond to it. So, I mean, really kind of the tricky scenario is what if you have, you know, a civilian who has a, you know, concealed weapon and decides to try to respond, you know, to that shooting situation. You know, the issue is that, you know, that person is going to have to try to evaluate who the shooter is, as, you know, perhaps among a group of individuals. And one, there's the risk that they may shoot the wrong person and actually, you know, cause more injuries and more damage than, you know, even if they're in good intent, than is already occurring. The other problem is, of course, what if law enforcement responds to the scene, you know, and then they have to evaluate who the shooter is now. And now you have two individuals who have weapons, or you have, you know, a sort of free-for-all melee going on. The officers may also make, you know, unfortunate decisions. So usually as part of the training, you know, for these types of programs, they say that really defense is the last resort. So you really want to try to disengage, if you can, from this sort of situation. But you may have to resort to defense if you've been trapped or you're right in close proximity with a shooter or a perpetrator. And then if law enforcement does come onto the scene, you really need to respond by, you know, keeping your hands visible, you know, following all instructions of law enforcement to make sure that you're not mistakenly identified as being a perpetrator by law enforcement as well.
Absolutely, I agree.
Joe, I wonder, what are the types of questions? I mean, if you run a seminar like this, you must be hearing a lot of concerns from the people in your community. What are their concerns?
Well, they want to know what to look for, how they can help us if they see somebody. And, you know, the thing is, right now with the terrorism and the Islamic terrorism throughout the world, it's just not Islamic terrorism. We have homegrown terrorists. This could be any sort of mentally ill person that just wants to get even with somebody, workplace violence. So, you know, they're asking, what do we do in a situation? What can we do? How can we help? And this seminar hopefully gives some information that can help people. And getting back to Chris, you know, yeah, of course, defense is the last thing you want to do. But at the end of the day, you have a right to protect yourself. And if you cannot get away or put a barrier between yourself and the suspect shooting, you know, be aggressive and commit to your actions and don't fight fairly. At the end of the day, you can sit there and die or fight and try to survive. And then when law enforcement arrives, and it could take, you know, in cities it's about 3 minutes, but in rural areas it could take 5-10 minutes for law enforcement to get there, and that could seem like an eternity. But when they get there, understand law enforcement, they're in a stressful situation too. They don't know what's going on. So follow instructions. You know, you may be handcuffed. We don't know who the shooter is. So when people come out, you know, and then the first thing we're doing is looking for that shooter. We're not going to be able to help people who may have been injured. We're going to try to stop the threat as immediate as possible.
And we only have about a minute left or so, Chris, but 2 hours is a first step. 2 hours isn't going to train you how to handle this situation psychologically, right?
No, not at all, but yeah, it is a first step.
Joe, yeah, you wanted to echo that?
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the idea, I think, is, you know, the chief was saying is to, you know, take this information and bring it back and, you know, engage in some sort of training on site of your place of business or your school or whatever. It's sort of thing of like fire drills in the house. You know, you sort of teach your kids how to get out of a house in the act of, you know, if a
right.
fire breaks out. And it's kind of the same idea, that sort of rehearse
right.
what you're going to do in an emergency situation.
That's Joe Werthmann, chief of police in Jefferson, Georgia. Chris Ferguson teaches psychology at Stetson University in Central Florida. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
During the racial turmoil of the 1960s, Atlanta was unique among southern cities for the cooperation between white and black leaders in order to maintain peace. That's been referred to as the Atlanta Way. And a new documentary explains how that happened. The film is called Making of Modern Atlanta. It's produced in partnership with the Andrew Young Foundation and Georgia State University. Here to tell us more about the film is Andrea Young. She's the executive producer and the daughter of civil rights icon Andrea Young. Good morning and welcome.
Greg, good morning. It's great to be here.
Can you, I bet there's people who have never heard of the Atlanta Way. Can
right.
you explain what that is?
Right. Well, the Atlanta Way is cooperation. I like to talk about that Atlanta's way of doing things is sort of tolerance and transportation. So we're a city where people came together to solve problems, even working behind the scenes, so that you didn't have open conflict, but you resolved things in a peaceful way and created win-win-win solutions.
Now, one of the things that the documentary makes clear is that it's not like Atlanta didn't have the racial tensions that other cities did.
Oh.
It's not like they didn't have racism or dissatisfaction or anger. Mm. But it talked a little bit about how it overcame that.
Right.
Do you think that was because of certain individuals, such as as you know, executives from Coca-Cola and other places? Do you think it was because of the people here?
Well, I think the people here, and we have a quote from Kasim Reed saying, you know, they chose cooperation over conflict. We had people here, I say, which understood, and Atlanta had a long tradition of saying we have to rise above the white supremacist notions in the South if we're going to prosper and attract, you know, first national investment, then international. So we did have Coca-Cola that was a global company that served people of all colors, and they did not want to be identified with a city that had a terrible racial heritage, like the kinds of things you saw in Birmingham. So here, people sat down and met and talked and worked. And we did have student sit-ins. Atlanta University students sat in at lunch counters. You had some, you know, strong reactions to that. But we had the ability to sit down, black and white, together and work out solutions.
So your father changed the way he was mayor in the late 1980s. Mm-hmm. He changed the way business in Atlanta was run. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you about how the Atlanta way has bled over into modern Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So here's Harvey Newman from the documentary. Mm-hmm. He's professor emeritus at the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies.
He increased the minority business requirements from 25 to 35%. But he did so in a way that was less confrontational than his predecessor.
How did what we call the Atlanta way, how has that survived and made Atlanta a different city now?
Well, we have this long legacy of business, both political partnerships and business partnerships. And it really starts with William Hartsfield, creating ongoing relationships with African-American leaders.
The mayor, you know, of the
city. The mayor then that the airport is named for. And going through to today where we have joint venture partnerships. So when you see the huge new stadium going up, black and white owned construction companies are building that. Our Atlanta airport, which was Maynard Jackson, held the line, and that which was confrontational, to say it had to be built with minority participation at the business at every level, of from bond selling to paving the parking lots to designing electrical systems. So that's the difference in the prosperity that you see in Atlanta. Our integration, if you will, of the economy has also progressed and become part of the Atlanta way.
So I wonder why put all the resources into this documentary. And the reason I ask that is that are you concerned that some of this history, these connections may not be made between the Atlanta way and Atlanta today?
Absolutely. I was in my Leadership Atlanta class in 2008. And these leaders did not know these core stories. They don't know that Ivan Allen was a white mayor in the South here in Atlanta who testified in support of the Civil Rights Act. They don't know that Atlanta hosted a dinner for Martin Luther King when he won the Nobel Prize. It was the first multiracial formal dinner in the South. They don't know that the airport was built on time and under budget with minority and the first female participation in terms of business participating as business partners. They don't really even know that even the Olympics was 20 years ago and what a transformation it was. A segregated city in 1960 could not have hosted a multinational, multiracial event of the Olympics in 1996, which has been such a tremendous boost to our regional economy. And so people don't really understand the legacy of and the underpinnings of our prosperity and our economy.
Well, my guest is Andrea Young. She's the executive producer of the new documentary, It's Making of Modern Atlanta. It airs tonight at 8 on GPB TV. Andrea, it's a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much.
The White House Press Corps was an exclusive club of all-male, mostly white reporters until Alice Dunnigan came to town. Alice shook things up, not only by being an African-American woman, but because of her devotion to pressing politicians to speak about civil rights. Here she is posing a question about tenant farmers to John F. Kennedy at his first news conference as president in 1961.
Yes, ma'am.
Does your administration plan to take any steps to solve the problem at Fayette County, Tennessee, where tenant farmers have been evicted from their homes because they voted last November and must now live in tents?
We are, the Congress, of course, enacted legislation which placed very clear responsibility on the executive branch to protect the right of voting. I supported that legislation.
It's hard to hear her there because she's not mic'd, but she's asking the president a pretty tough question about farmers who were evacuated from their land. Alice Dunnigan's career as a White House reporter spanned several administrations. In 1974, she penned a memoir about her time in Washington, and a new edition of that autobiography, called Alone Atop the Hill, was recently reissued by UGA Press. I spoke with the book's editor, Carol Booker, and I began the conversation by asking her why they decided to change the title of the book when it was reissued. It was originally called A Black Woman's Experience from Schoolhouse to the White House.
Well, there were two reasons. The primary one was it didn't reflect the depths, really, from which she rose. And Alice asks us at the beginning of her autobiography to judge her not by the heights that she reached, but by the depths from which she rose. And that was as a daughter of a sharecropper and a laundress. She struggled hand over fist to become a rural school teacher. And so the original title, saying From Schoolhouse to the White House, left out the struggle of her early life to do that. Another reason was, some detractors, and she had many, particularly among men. She says in the book she suffered more sex discrimination than race discrimination, and some of her male competitors, detractors, substituted outhouse for a schoolhouse.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I wanted to go back briefly before we talk about her incredibly storied career in D.C. and talk about her childhood a little bit. Could you tell us how much of a struggle it was for her to complete her education and actually have any kind of certification to become a teacher?
Oh, it was extremely difficult. First of all, she lived 2 miles outside of Russellville, Georgia, a town of I think it was about 5,000 then. She lived on a hill, no other kids around, and she wanted desperately to go to school. She just wanted, probably partially out of loneliness, and to be with other children. And so she walked by herself the 2 miles to school and the 2 miles home in all kinds of weather. And her father even taunted her, saying it was foolish to go out when it was raining or in the snow. And her mother had second thoughts, but she bundled her up nevertheless. Alice finished the only school available for blacks in that area. It was called the Knob City High School, but it was 8 elementary school grades and 2 years of high school. And then when she finished, her parents so disappointed her by telling her they didn't have the money to send her on for further education.
Yeah. But she was saved by actually a local dentist.
Yes, she was the Sunday school secretary, and after a terribly miserable summer, knowing that her school friends were going off to college, many of them who were worse off than she was, some of them had widowed parents and less money, but still her parents still. They felt they didn't have the money for this, and her father felt no one in his family had ever been a teacher, so why should she? But to Alice, the choices were quite stark. It was either become a teacher or become a domestic servant in the home of a white family, and she didn't want that. She really wanted dignity and respect and the opportunity to use her intellect.
Let's speed forward a little bit and take us to the moment when she began to get involved in reporting. What brought her at least to writing reports?
Well, she actually admits in the book that she doesn't know where she got the idea that she wanted to be a reporter as well as a teacher, because there were no black newspapers in her community, and certainly no opportunity for reporting on news of interest to the black community in the white press. But somehow she developed this. And when she was about 13, a cousin who was teaching over in Owensboro put her in touch with the local newspaper over there, a Black Weekly. And she started writing a little column of interest, news of interest about her community, sending it in. And the editor would give her a number of newspapers to sell in exchange, and she could keep 3 cents out of the 5 cents price of the newspaper.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. We had that clip of tape of her asking a question to John F. Kennedy. And one of the things that comes to light in the memoir is the different way she was treated by different presidential administrations. How did that actually, I mean, obviously JFK, you point out, was a very different president in terms of how he treated her than Eisenhower, for example.
Oh, this was a major turning point in that news conference that you just played. Alice had asked the same kinds of questions, always civil rights questions, for the 8 years that Eisenhower was in office, and she attended just about every one of his almost weekly news conferences. But Eisenhower got very irritated at her for asking civil rights questions. He didn't want to talk about civil rights. He didn't know the answer sometimes, and he didn't want any questions that he couldn't answer. So he would chastise her and say, "Why are you asking me that? Have you asked the Bureau of Engraving, or have you asked the Department of Agriculture?" As if the heads of these federal agencies and departments did not have accountability to the President of the United States on a constitutional
right, and then he began ignoring her entirely.
Oh, for years. 2 years, and then he'd ask her a question, answer a question. And then from 1958 until he left office in January 61, he didn't call on her at all.
Tell me about the moment when she kind of scooped all of her other reporters catching the president speaking about civil rights in his pajamas.
Well, after just through sheer grit and persistence, getting credentialed for the House and Senate press galleries where there were no blacks, and then getting credentials for the White House press corps, she got on a trip with President Truman. It was called a non-campaign, non-political trip, but actually it was the forerunner of his campaign for the presidency, or, you know, his own term. So she's on the trip, and the instructions are to hop off at every stop and mingle with the crowd, try to get some local color, try to get a black angle for her stories. And there was one unscheduled stop in Missoula, Montana, a college town. And a bunch of maybe 100 or so college kids had gathered along the train tracks to see the president's train and hopefully get a glimpse of the president. So the train stopped, and Alice and some of the other reporters jumped off, and President Truman came out on the rear platform in his pajamas and robe and addressed the students. And they yelled questions up at him. And he had not talked about civil rights from this point. This is from the train trip from Washington all the way to Montana. And because it was unpopular among whites at the time, although it was the number one topic in the black community. And one of the students yelled out, "Mr. President, what do you think about civil rights?" And Truman answered, "I think it's as old as the Constitution and as new as the Democratic Party platform of 1944. And then he went on to intimate that it would also be a part of the platform in 1948.
That was Carol Booker. She's the editor of Alone Atop the Hill, an autobiography of journalist Alice Dunnigan. And here's a story that you might be interested in. The University of Georgia broke ground on its Baldwin Hall project in December of 2014. And for a year, everything went as planned. But in November, when the crew started tearing up a parking lot, they found something that wasn't in the plan, a human skull. Work on the building stopped, and an excavation began. In the end, crews found remains from nearly 30 people, and the university isn't entirely sure where they came from. It's possible the bodies were once part of the old Athens Cemetery. It's not that far from the construction site. It's a 205-year-old burial site that houses maybe 5,000 grave sites, including a number of Confederate soldiers and even Revolutionary War soldiers. Many of the graves are unmarked. The University of Georgia has hired consultants to try and determine whose remains lay beneath that parking lot and where they should be reinterred. Only then will construction resume. Whenever Baldwin Hall is completed, though, I'm guessing the building might have a few ghost stories in place from the day it opens. This is On Second Thought. When we talk about the Jim Crow South, we often talk about segregation between blacks and whites. But racial tension had a broad effect on everyone living in the South. Drinking fountains were often labeled either white or black, but many Latinos wondered which one they were supposed to use, and whether or not segregated lunch counters meant they weren't welcome also. In her new book, University of Oregon History Professor Julie Wise tracks the mass migration of Latinos to the South and what they faced when they got here, and she joins me now. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Celeste.
We also have Javier Gonzalez with us. He's a descendant of some of those early migrants. He grew up doing field work, but these days he oversees multicultural programs at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Tifton. It's good to have you as well, Javier.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Celeste.
When did your family arrive in Georgia?
We started settling in Georgia in the late 1970s.
And you came from where, Texas?
From Texas, yes, South Texas.
So how did you end up here?
Well, my parents were recruited. Back then, farmers hired recruiters to go out, and they would go to South Texas and other places to recruit farm labor. And my parents were one of those that saw the advertisements and said, let's try this, and packed up our family and ended up in Georgia.
And the thing is, having looked at your bio, Javier, it looks like you moved around a lot. So what was it about Georgia that made them stay?
It was full-year employment. As a migrant, as migrant workers, we would follow the crops. Or they would follow the crops, and we would follow. But Georgia... in Georgia, he found stable year unemployment with one farmer who had worked for him and the family throughout the year.
So, Julie, how typical is that story, the story of Javier's family?
What I found in my research is that it's actually quite typical, that we have a long history going back really to the 1920s of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans being based in South Texas, or in some cases Mexico, and moving seasonally through the country to harvest crops. Oftentimes spending summer in the Midwest. But what happened as Georgia's agricultural production became more seasonal, less cotton-based, was that people who were spending the winter months in places like Texas or Florida could find employment in Georgia, and they wouldn't have to go all the way to, let's say, the Midwest. So because of the climate of Georgia being able to accommodate crops in various different seasons, it became an attractive destination in the 1970s and 1980s for families like Javier's, based both in Texas and also in Florida, who would come to Georgia maybe for part of the year, then most of the year, and then maybe realize they could stay all year.
So Javier, tell me about, what does your family talk about when they talk about what seemed strange in Georgia? Were there things here that stuck out in terms of kind of a culture clash?
Definitely. One of the most vivid one is being exposed to the African-American population, because coming from South Texas and living there the majority of the year, most of our influence and people were people like ourselves. They spoke our language. They looked like us. And even when we traveled as groups, we mainly stayed within our little communities. We traveled to Florida, and Florida was the same. But it was coming to Georgia where we got to get an extended view and exposure to the African American population. That was one of the most vivid changes.
You know, Javier, I grew up in Southern California, and that's another place where my hometown was Mission Viejo, and my high school mascot was a Diablo. Everywhere you go, things are in both Spanish and English.
Right.
That could not have been true here. Was there a language barrier that hadn't been there in Texas?
Oh, definitely, definitely. For my family and myself, it was academically challenging because we were doing well in Texas and under the bilingual programs that they have in South Texas. So we were functioning in our native Spanish language, and English was slowly being introduced as the student progressed through their education. The most difficult time was coming to Georgia, and South Georgia at that did not have the resources, either bilingual or English with speakers of other languages, to support what we needed.
So, Julie, you kind of begin your story of Mexicans in the South in 1910 or 1920. Why? What was happening then?
Well, the Mexican Revolution that unfolded over the course of the 19-teens is generally considered to be the most important precipitating event for the migrant streams that have really continued until this day, really until our recent recession, when we've seen net Mexican immigration effectively at zero. But prior to that, for a century, the Mexican Revolution was really the event that kicked off the modern Mexican migration to the United States. And while we are very aware that those immigrants were going to places like Texas, California, Chicago, it turns out that they were actually going all over the country. They were going to Alaska, they were going to Pennsylvania, and they were going to Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas in the 19-teens, really through the first part of the 20th century.
You have some great examples in your book of how that played out, especially as the civil rights movement began to brew up in the South, and that sort of strange place that Latinos and Mexicans held, not quite sure where they belonged. Can you give me an example?
Yes, absolutely. So if we look, for example, at Arkansas, during the 1950s, Mexican workers who were imported on temporary contracts, these workers were known as braceros, which comes from the Spanish word for arm. And during the 1950s, Mexican workers did about 25% of the cotton labor in Arkansas. They were a completely ubiquitous presence in the Arkansas Delta. What we saw there was a very interesting dynamic wherein Mexicans and African Americans, in oral history interviews and through other documentary evidence, it becomes clear that they were spending their free time together, that Mexicans felt most comfortable in African American bars and honky-tonks, as they would call them. But at the same time, the Mexican immigrants are appealing to the Mexican consulate for the right to be admitted to white businesses and restaurants from which they were excluded. And they ultimately win that fight because the Mexican government says to the white employers, if you don't put pressure on these businesses and these public spaces to admit Mexicans, we're not going to give this area any bracero contracts next year. And because the farmers wanted that labor so badly, they worked very, very hard to secure Mexicans' admission to white public spaces. However, what's not really clear is that any of the Mexicans who were fighting those very fights actually wanted to spend their time in those places. They wanted to be recognized as equal. They wanted to be recognized as first-class citizens. They took up this issue. But all the evidence says that their free time, they actually preferred to spend time with African Americans.
So, Javier, let me take that straight to you and how that played out in your own personal life and with your family. You said it was Georgia was the first time you'd really been along a lot of African Americans. What did that look like in terms of socializing with your family?
Well, it was natural because that was the population that was doing the farm work. So we spent extended amounts of time out in the fields and the packing sheds and in social locations with that population. So socializing with them really promoted collaborations and friendships, particularly with that population more so than the white population.
Do you feel, and did your family feel, like they were in part of the civil rights movement, like as though that included Latinos in the South especially?
I don't believe so. My parents, they had basic education, primary level education, third and fifth grade educations, and their purpose for coming to Georgia was to do the work. So they were not involved, and we didn't know because lacking the language skills and the history skills, we were not aware of that struggle. It wasn't until later that we were established that we started, or I myself started to notice differences and wondering why these things are that. And then I realized the integration had just occurred, relatively speaking, and they were, the school system in particular, were struggling to figure out where we as the Mexican in-between population fit within those dynamics.
Where did you go to a segregated school?
No, I did not. But I did go to a school where there was tracking placement of students in tiers depending on their ability or potential. So when we enrolled in schools, we were placed in the lowest tiers possible. Some of my siblings were even placed in special education classes because I believe their lack of English proficiency. And we had to work our way through those barriers to get into the higher-achieving groups.
We're going to return to that in just a moment, Javier, because you're getting close to finishing your PhD now, right?
It's an EdD program, yes.
Yeah, that's a pretty amazing leap. But, Julie, help me understand. You know, I found it interesting. I want to read you a sentence that's from your promotional material, which I don't often do, but I found this interesting. They said that in your book you talk about how Latinos in the South shaped the Southern conservative imagination in the wake of the civil rights movement. What does that mean?
Well, what I'm referring to there is specifically things that were happening in South Georgia during the time that Javier's family was coming. And I'd be very interested in Javier's perspective about this as well. But what I argue in the book and what I found in my research is that this is a period when white Southerners are really beginning to be looked at by the rest of the country as the bad guys of the civil rights movement, the people who stood in the way of what ultimately came to be accepted as a somewhat general consensus that legal segregation was wrong. And of course, many, if not most, of these people came themselves to accept the idea that the harshness of the Jim Crow system was something that had to be placed into the past. At the same time, they were reaching out, other scholars have established, they were reaching out to African-American leaders, pastors, asking for forgiveness, that kind of thing. But that was extremely complicated. That was a very complicated way of making amends because not all of these African-American leaders wanted to simply say, yeah, we're going to forget about everything that happened, you know, since slavery times. Well, all of a sudden at this moment, enter this new population of Mexicans. Many of these conservative white Southerners had been on missions in Latin America. They had learned some Spanish. And so what we saw during this period of, I'll say, the 1970s, really through the 90s, was a somewhat quiet and uneasy peace in southern Georgia and similar agricultural areas, where on the one hand, you didn't have the migrant workers, as Javier said, organizing and protesting the way that migrant workers were doing really in many other parts of the country.
Cesar Chavez and similar things
in Florida and in Ohio, but not in Georgia. Similarly, you didn't see any real anti-immigrant movement coming neither from white nor black people in South Georgia's agricultural areas. Instead, there was this uneasy peace, and I argue that this was largely, or in some ways, an opportunity for conservative white Southerners, particularly those affiliated with churches, to sort of redeem themselves, to have this population that did not look like them, that represented difference, that they could go out to the camps, bring people food, charter buses to bring them to church. Conservative white Southerners who would invite 30 Mexican migrants over for Christmas, for dinner.
So that's the broad experience. Javier, give us the individual experience. Did you find among at least your family and the people that you knew, there was neither a big, strong political push for civil rights nor a feeling of anti-immigrant backlash?
Exactly. Just thinking on Julie's words, that the farmer who my parents settled with kind of took us in and made us part of his family. We shared Thanksgiving. He brought Christmas gifts, him and his wife and his extended family. So we were taken care of in that way. There was never a distinction where you would say, you know, we're being treated wrong or something's not right here. And just thinking back on that, it was more of a mutual respect relationship than a worker-employer relationship.
So before we go, Javier, I want to return to the story of your education, because I understand it. You actually keep a letter framed on your desk from one of your early teachers.
Yes. And this is from Virginia Roberts, and it's dated November 19th, 1980.
What grade were you in at this point?
Fifth grade, I believe.
Okay.
And it was when I moved to the permanent school system from another school system within Georgia. And it says, to whom it may concern, please do not judge Javier's ability by the grades he received from me. He is a very capable, polite person. His work was very good until he began being absent 1 to 3 days a week. His absence seemed to be due to the temporary nature of his father's job. Javier's concern for his schoolwork seemed lessened when the cucumber crop came in. My plea to you is give him a few days to adjust to the new school. You will find him easy to learn and a pleasure to teach.
Why do you keep this? I mean, it's like an absolute reflection of your family and the realization of the American dream in one way, but why do you keep that on your desk?
It motivates me. It makes me realize that people do care. I didn't see my potential at that age, obviously, but someone else took interest in me and made sure that whoever was going to be receiving me at the next school felt the same way.
That is Javier Gonzalez. He's the director of multicultural programs at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College in Tifton, Georgia. I also spoke with University of Oregon professor Julie Wise. She's the author of the book Corazón de Dixie, which means Heart of Dixie, Mexicanos in the U.S. South since 1910. Julie and Javier, thank you both so much.
Thanks to
you
both.
Thank you, Bob.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow, though, we'll talk about the Georgia legislature and the effort to pass a religious liberty bill. Do you think religious leaders in the state need protection from the interference of the government? Give us your thoughts at 404-500-9457, or you can tweet us at OST Talk, or maybe post your response to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.